of a man that was still recognizable as Lauren Morse. Their presence, their existence, put a grin on her face that was so wide it ached, and so deep she felt it in her chest. Lauren Morse stood at the window, looking out at the vastness of the sky like he was seeing it for the first time. Jellet was propped between the centrifuge and the kitchen counter, with Ricker and Cinia and Tonner, all so tightly packed in that it seemed like they'd crawl into each other's laps. Jellet, with his bandaged leg, was sitting. The others looked like supplicants, allowed to stand before the merry, delighted king. Jessen herself was with Alston and Else and Daffod in the hall, pushed out of the main living space by the lab equipment and the press of three new bodies. "So, there I am, yeah?" Alston said, stripped, naked, and dragged along by the beast's leash, like the world's least plausible virgin sacrifice, trotting through the halls with all the demons the gallantists could dream up looking at my cock like they were wondering if it was removable. I'm sick. I'm dizzy, spun up. I don't have any idea what's going to happen to me. You all had something like that, yeah? We kept our clothes, Jessen said. Daffod laughed. Speak for yourself. I had clothes, sort of, but they weren't mine. Alston wagged a finger between himself and the younger man, you and me. So it was that moment, and the great fucking beast hauls me into this room, four other people in it, and one of them is my department chair, woman I've known for 15 years. They're all in the local uniform by then. So I'm the only one wearing my Pope's robes, if you see what I mean. The beast starts making introductions, and this woman, Marrow, her name is, you'll meet her. Marrow starts blushing, and she's staring me in the eye so as not to look elsewhere. So I look back. We've locked eyes. And I don't know why, but little Alston starts taking the moment for something it ain't. Else buried her shriek in her hands, shaking her head with hilarity. You didn't. Oh, God, that's not true. You can ask anyone, Alston said. They were all there. Not like there was any point trying to hide it. So the great fucking beast cuts me loose, and I excuse myself, wash up, because I was fair a wild man by then, and when I come back out, clothed now, mind you, everyone's formal and dour and pretending like I hadn't just waved at 'em all with my hands tied. Daffod choked, his shoulders trembling with mirth. Normal biological reaction, Tonner shouted at them from the kitchen. Humans have been getting horny in the face of death since the beginning of the species. Don't you hate it when some killjoy tries to explain away the joke? Kumpar shouted back at him. So, Alston continued, as though no one else had spoken, what could I do to break the ice now that I'd already shown everyone my best material? The sly smile after it was funnier than the punchline, and Jessen had to lean against the wall and catch her breath. She'd known people like Alston before, natural performers who made themselves the center of every conversation. Usually they grated on her nerves, but not now, not today. In the space by the kitchen, Jellet was holding the latest bright-colored knot turtle that they were meant to be feeding. The others had been used to make basic protein assays or had starved to death while the group's attention had been elsewhere. This most recent one had a line of crimson along its jaw that might have meant something in a different evolutionary context. Here, it was just decoration. Meaningless. Tonner, to judge from the motions of his hands and the few words that Jessen caught, was speeding Jellet through months of research and theorizing, and Jellet was doing his best to seem like he followed it all or cared. Very polite of him. Jessen felt soft, relaxed, like a pain she'd carried so long she'd stopped noticing it until it eased. Lauren turned away from the view, ambling toward the four of them with a vague, stunned expression. The months of their captivity hadn't been kind to him. The last time Jessen had seen the man, he'd been on a screen on Agian, talking about the objects he'd discovered and their mysterious approach. His skin was grayer now, and he had a patchy beard. He'd shed enough weight that his cheekbones had gone sharp. He looked ill, but maybe they all did. Certainly none of them were the people they had been. "This place is beautiful," Lauren Moore said. "These are the best quarters I've seen them give any of us." "It's the window, isn't it?" Else asked, giving Daffod a conspiratorial wink. "I don't know how long it's been since I saw an outside," Lauren said. "I've been living in a prison cell." "We all have," Else said, "even with the view." Lauren's smile was real but thoughtful. There was something behind it that Jessen couldn't quite fathom. Daffod made a small sound and raised a hand like he was a child in a schoolroom. "The Carricks that took you to your workgroup, do you know if it was the same librarian we have?" The question was directed at Alston, but Lauren answered, "How would we know? We didn't spend a lot of time chatting. It hauled us all together, told us to apply the scanning protocols Morse here was using for his heliospheric work to their pet datasets, and vanished. Did you ever try to find it again?" Alston chuckled and cuffed Daffod's shoulder. "We'll want to arm up before we do that, yeah?" In the main room, Tonner said something, and Ricker laughed. It was strange to see them getting along. Jellit scratched his head and asked them something she couldn't quite make out. Tonner launched into an answer, his hands moving in a kind of pantomime that could have been protein structure or evolutionary pairing maps, or maybe just Tonner needing to get out more information at once than a single channel of speech could carry. Lauren Morse cleared his throat, catching the whole room's attention, and said, "I don't think we're going to break Jellit's family reunion up anytime soon, but Alston and I should be getting back." "I'll go with you," Tonner said, maybe a little too quickly. "Jellit can take my room." There was a flicker of something in Else's expression, embarrassment or regret or guilt at Tonner's hunger to be away from her and her new lover. "I'd like to see your place too," Ricker said. "Can I tag along?" "Ooh," Kumpar said, "a sleepover, only without the booze and dancing." "Might be some dancing," Alston said. "One can never rule it out. I'll take these three with. We've got room enough for them now." Lauren's expression sobered, and Jessen wondered how Jellit's work group had come to have the extra space. At a guess, it would be a lot like how they had Irina's room open. Still, the darkness passed quickly. It wasn't long before Tonner, Kumpar, and Ricker were headed out the wide door, following Alston like he was the teacher, and they were all heading to their first day at a new school. The night had fallen long before, and the dawn would be a long time coming. They moved the equipment and made a circle on the floor with cushions from the seats and pillows from the beds, sat and lounged and talked like they were all young again, like the universe still had joy in it. And so, for a while, it did. Jellit and Lauren Morse told their story. The broad strokes were all familiar, and it made the details matter more. The two of them had shared the passage, and so they took turns telling the stories of it. The man who'd tried to kill one of the other prisoners. The woman who'd started hallucinating spirits from beyond space and time. The group that had started a choir and spent their time in hell singing together. Then their placement in a room and their version of the alcove, though this one was stocked with visualization arrays and single photon diffraction slopes and banks of telescopic data that might have been real or simulated. Daffod and Sinia told about the attempted coup and the alien that had exploded and made everyone sick as dogs, and how that had led to Daffod spending days in the ruins of a pink nightgown. If Jellit and Lauren Morse exchanged a glance at that one, or seemed to already know the details of it, Jessen didn't notice at the time. It should have been terrible, And it was. But telling the stories and singing the songs and laughing about it all let Jessen feel like they had some power over the horror. "And how did you wind up tracking us down?" Lauren Morse asked. "I'd given up on finding you."
"I didn't," Jellit said.
"That's true. Jellit would have kept looking until doomsday. He made contact with three other groups all on his own."
"How many of us are there out there?" Jessen asked.
"We found a couple dozen groups," Jellit said. "There are more out there. At least I hope there are."
But, Lauren Morse said with a laugh, "I still want the story. How did you find us?"
"That was Daffod," Els said and touched his arm. The younger man had the good taste to blush. Jessen retold the war with the night drinkers and the peace offerings they'd made. Her brother and Lauren Morse listened like she was reciting a vast epic, and at the end, Lauren looked puzzled.
"But that wasn't, no offense, but that wasn't Daffod here, was it?" Jellit said.
"That sounds like you, if it was anybody."
"My part was after," Daffod said. "When we got the device, we could talk with the other inmates instead of just gawking at them as they passed. Daffod was the one who started asking them if they'd come across one of us that smelled like Jessen," Els said.
"Well," the boy said, more defensive than he needed to be, "I figured since they were siblings, and a lot of animals on Agian, animals on both trees of life, were better at chemoreception, that it made sense to ask. Does make you wonder if that's why the red shower cleanser is changing our smell," Jessen said. "Maybe there's something in the human odor spectrum that's causing crossed signals with some other chemorecepting species."
"Or the Karaks themselves," Els agreed.
"And the Karaks already had the red goo waiting for us when we arrived, so they already knew what the problem would be," Jessen continued, "and the solution."
"An interesting idea," Els said.
"Stop sciencing all over my story," Jellit said. "The fact is that it worked."
But Lauren Morse looked grave.
"It's just, we're all talking about home in the past tense these days. Like it isn't still out there."
All of them grew sober. There were a few tries at getting the euphoria back, but the night had wilted on them, and before long, Cynia declared she was going to get ready for sleep. They took Lauren to Tonner's room as they broke up for the night. Els and Daffod both went to her room, and no one said anything about it. This was how things were now. Things that would have been unthinkable were normal now. Jessen and Jellit stayed in the front room with the berries and the not turtle and the messy dishes from their dinner. For a while, they were quiet, just doing simple domestic chores together. Jessen ran warm water in the sink, washed the dishes, and handed them to her brother to dry. His eyes kept sliding to the window. The dark had turned it into a kind of half-mirror. The two of them in the kitchen, and also the distant ziggurats of the Karaks, glowing faintly. The superposition seemed like it meant something, like a dream that carried some significance.
"I was worried about you," Jellit said.
"I was worried about me too," she said. "I was afraid I wouldn't see you again. We got lucky."
For a moment, he seemed like he was on the verge of saying something more, but instead he kissed her forehead. Afterward, she lay in her bed and willed herself to sleep, but her nerves wouldn't let it come. Now that the first bright candy coating of the day had washed off, her mind was taken up by what the joy and surprise had under them. It wasn't as simple as the pleasure had been. She shifted in the bed that her captors had given her, her pillow bunching at the base of her skull or flattening until it hardly felt like more than a fold of thick cloth. Images floated into her unquiet mind. The cafe she'd gone to at Dian Academy, the music that used to filter down through the ceiling of her first rooms at Irvian,
their upstairs neighbors' chords resonating with the softly curving coral of the grown walls. The first boy she'd kissed. The first girl who'd kissed her. The taste of a cold beer on a hot summer afternoon. Seeing Jellet's face, hearing Lauren Morse's voice, even meeting Alston for the first time, all of it conspired to remind her of the life that was gone. And it made her present circumstances clear. She remembered one of her therapists saying, "Anger is pain in a party mask." It had seemed wise at the time. She wasn't sure she agreed with it anymore. Maybe anger was a scab over a wound. Or maybe it was what happened when the universe spun you so hard that you lost everything. Or maybe it was just a thing that welled up in you when you found yourself lying sleepless in the dark of a prison work camp with no idea what your future might be, or if your past mattered. She didn't remember opening her eyes, but they were open again. The ceiling was a darkness with just the thinnest spill of gray where the crack at the top of the door let the light in. She watched it shift as someone walked past in the hallway. She didn't recognize the footsteps, so Lauren Morse. Everyone else was as familiar as a song heard for the thousandth time. Jessen levered herself up. Sleep wasn't happening, and lying in the darkness wouldn't change that. She could check on the latest run of changes to the Berry's internal farmland, or sample the latest not turtle for more data about what might sustain the one after. Or, if she was lucky, find someone in the main rooms who she could talk to until the version of herself she'd created to survive in prison slipped back into place. Something. In the hallway, Sinia's door stood open. Lauren Morse leaned against the frame, his head bowed, speaking low. Sinia was before him, her eyes on his mouth like she was reading lips. Jessen paused when she saw the open hunger in the older woman's eyes, and a little hit of adrenaline eased into her bloodstream. She heard Sinia say, "Yes, tell him I'll help," before she noticed Jessen watching, and the more familiar look returned. Lauren Morse followed her glance, smiled at Jessen, and gave her a nod before pushing off back down the hallway toward Tonner's empty room. "Everything all right?" Jessen asked, feeling how idiotic the question was even as she asked it. "Fine," Sinia said. Her eyes were bright and hard. "Everything's fine." Jessen didn't know then who Lauren Morse and Sinia had been talking about, but she'd have been very damned surprised if it turned out things were really fine. Chapter 27. "How long have we spent looking for other people?" Daffod asked. Else shrugged as they turned down the hallway toward the cathedral-wide common room where their alcove once was. "Depends on how you count it," she said. But David was too much in his own mind to follow her thought. "And as soon as we had the translator, we found them. The same day. I keep wondering, if we'd thought to ask the librarian for one of these on our own, would it have given it to us?" The square itself was in his hand, lighter than its size would suggest. There was a loop where a strap or a lanyard could go, but there was nothing there. No place to open it, no way to access its interior, nothing that showed where it took its power from. When it functioned, the whole body of the thing vibrated and grew cool, like its effort drew in more energy than it put out. There were a million mysteries that the object posed, and Daffod was too excited by the idea of using it to pause at any of them. If they were easy to get hold of, it wouldn't have been much of a peace offering, Els said, Her voice was tense in a way he thought he understood. "Maybe," Daffod said, "but when the Carrick see us carrying it, they don't seem to care. So either we're not prohibited from having one, or enforcement of the rules is surprisingly lax." Ahead of them, the flow of traffic thickened. But today the overwhelming strangeness of the bodies that passed was leavened by Daffod's sense of possibility. Before, they had all been like animals in a pandemonic zoo, inmates in a prison separated by impossible gulfs of language. Now, each one was the chance to know more, to understand more, to get his head around what had happened to him and everyone he'd known. A broad-shouldered thing with six legs and bright rills down its sides lumbered by, crossing paths with a group of four fast-crawling stilt-legged things with iridescent black shells. A swarm of not-quite insects rolled past in the high air. "So," Daffod said, "where do we start?" "It is the size of a large horse, covered in chitin the color of bone. Its legs articulate strangely, folding with each step and then extending until they seem to thin to almost nothing. Its eyes are deeply set, and a bioluminescent glow flickers at its joints like static charges grounding out. When it speaks, it chitters. We were the phylarchs of Astrodim once. Once we were, though that was long ago. We hold the memory of those times close, and we share it so that it never fades. 100 worlds we called our own, though they were shared with the Elmrath and Coli, who were found wanting in the eyes of the Great Ones and thus culled. They are gone now, but we carry their bones in our songs and memories. We built palace worlds and temples to our own ingenuity with roots that sank to the planetary mantle and rose to the edge of space. They lived, those buildings. They held worlds within them, and we were proud, or that is the history. We were proud, and the proud are brought down, our philosophers warned, though now we call them prophets. The Carricks came and yoked our young. They bound the architects and stripped the stations of the gods to use for storage sheds. The Elmrath, they drove from their paper hives and drowned in the sea. The Coli, they took as they took all things then, to a white plain above a lavender sea. Under that cold sun, the beautiful Coli lost their will to live, withered, and passed to dust. But we carried our souls within us. Cut from all we had known, we built. All of this you see, we built. Not the Carricks. They live well within it. They make use of it. Even then, they see only its use, not its spirit. They have no soul for it. We do not weep for them. One servant sees a slice of the spectrum, hears a fraction of the music, and is content. Why should the masters be different? No, no, we are grateful. The Carricks have given us a wider sky to grow into, 1,000 more palace worlds than we had dreamed to construct. We are grateful for the chance to build, and pleased with our place within the function of the whole. We remember our childhood playmates, the Elmrath, the Coli. We are grateful, grateful, grateful not to be them. We are not phylarchs any longer, nor will I see the spires of Astrodim before my eyes are dust. But what we still are. And if I were not pleased by that, I would not be anything at all. Do you see? Do you hear that? We love them, and we live. We eat their leavings, and we smile, and they give us our draught of pleasure. I would not say this if I were not valued, but you are young. Do as we have done. It is the best life that remains to you. If they're individuals, then they're the size of horseflies, but fleshy and pink. If the cloud of them is only one animal of many parts, then it's a little smaller than a child's ball. The buzzing it makes varies in timbre and volume, but the change that comes when it speaks is a scent like cabbage and mint. No, I will not talk with you. I will not tell you my name. Whatever it is you're planning will fail, and all of your kind will burn. Go away. We will not burn with you. Go away. The alcove is structurally similar to the one they had for their research. A little length of hall leading off from the vast main chamber. There, however, the similarity ends. The walls here are crusted with ropey tendrils like finger-thick vines. A soft ticking sound comes from them, and a deep, rich, swampy scent fills the air. Glimmers of golden light flicker on and off again, illuminating pale grubs that cling to the surfaces. When it speaks, nothing in the room seems to change. It isn't clear if the vines are speaking, or the grubs, or the room. History? I have no history. Maybe I did once, but how would I know? To rise isn't the same as to unfall. What is lost, and why regret a dream I had when I was young just because the universe woke me from it? I'm here, and I have no ambition to be elsewhere. Other instances are in other places. They do what the great ones need them to do. Scrub air in places where it's tainted. Take in what is polluted and put out what is pure, depending on what the great ones say is tainted and what they want made pure. It doesn't matter to me. My place is here, in this space. I learn how to do what it wants, and then I am harvested, and I learn again. But I never leave. How would I? Nothing here has a history, except for the Carricks. I don't. You don't. None of those things muttering outside do, even the ones who think they do. They can't. Having a past of my own with the Carricks is like having a shadow in the dark. It might be pleasant, or it might not. But since it's impossible, it isn't either one. My home world? I don't understand the question. I don't have a home world. I don't have a home. I don't have a world. Wherever I was plucked from, I was plucked from. From. I have a task, and I do it. Anything more than that hurts. Name? I had a name. I don't know what it was. You should stop. I don't like talking with you anymore. It is a little over knee high, and twice as broad. The form of its shell suggests that it evolved in liquid. It looks made to slip through something thicker than air. Its three sets of legs are short, wide, and flexible as tentacles, though there are distinct and visible joints. It has strips of cloth and brightly colored stones as clothing or ornament. If I talk to you, I will be killed. It is a standing flicker of blue, like a flame without the heat. There are shapes inside the light, generating the glow and shaping it like a swarm of gnats built from crystal. They're hard to see, hard to look at. When the voice box translates, it doesn't make sounds, but glimmers. We are the Carricks. There is no difference between them and us. Yes, 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 I know about bodies. They aren't significant. But all nature is porous. Once there was the carrying one, but its children are gone. Its harp is broken. The singing of the stones has gone quiet. There is no sorrow in that, but joy. None of those things were the Carricks, and we are. Why would we celebrate the enemies of what we are? Before, we sang for base reasons. We were in service of nothing, of ourselves. Now, we are part of the greatness. We sing the songs of war, and through our singing spread that which we are. Yes, I know, but we are the Carricks. What ennobles the Carricks ennobles us. What strengthens the Carricks strengthens us. This is the beautiful way. Submission to glory is glorification, and we are glorious. I have to sit down, Els said. Her face had gone ashen. Daffod followed her to the edge of the huge chamber. The voices and sounds of 1,000 individuals from hundreds of worlds filled the air. And it sounded weirdly like a train station, as if all the hubbub, however exotic the setting and the source, was on some level also all the same. She sank to the ground, her elbows resting on her knees. Daffod sat down beside her. After a moment, he put a hand on her shin, comforting her without knowing exactly why she needed comfort. Overwhelmed? There's so much, she said. Half a day, and look how much more we know. All the things I've seen up to now, all the things I've learned. We know more about the Carricks, and then it turns out we've barely taken a sip. She gestured out at the passing crowd. Daffod saw another of the phylarchs of Astrodim lumbering gently among the bodies, and it was almost like recognizing a friend. The eeriness wasn't gone, but it was less because he knew something. We could find clues about what worlds they all came from, she said, what they all do for the Carricks, how the Carricks gather them up, domesticate them, use them. We could know so much. We will, given time, Daffod said. It didn't seem to reassure her. But really, who are we going to tell? Her gaze shifted, the dark of her eyes fixed on him, like she was seeing him there for the first time. The ashen look was fading, and something that was almost a blush was coming into its place. She opened her mouth as if she were going to speak, but then closed it again and shook her head. Is something going on? Daffod asked. I mean, you seem, I don't know, like something's going on, she said. And her voice was low and teasing, like a gently mocking viol. Well, yes. Her eyes softened, and a small, rueful smile appeared on her lips. I would like to be able to tell you everything, even the parts that are hard. That's what I'm here for. That's all I want. The smile widened, complicated, teased. That's not all you want. It's not, but it is part of it. Something huge passed between them and the light at the top of the cathedral. The shadow fell over them and passed in a flicker. Els curled her fingers around his. I'm not going to be good for you, she said. I'm not going to make you happy. You already do. Look, I understand that we don't have much freedom. We are powerless to choose most of the things that shape our lives. But what we do have, what we can have, I want. Does that make sense? Not absolutely, she said, then shook her head. I mean, we're not absolutely powerless, were just mostly powerless. A deep and subtle difference. It made her smile. That was a victory. I'm not what you think I am, Daffod. I look forward to meeting you. Over and over and over. She laughed. Oh, you have no idea what you're saying. I'm in love. People in love never know what they're saying. Her fingers were warm on his cheek, but her smile had gone rueful again. Something in the crowd caught her attention, and the moment was gone. Els sat forward and gestured with her chin, pointing out and to their right. Is that our librarian? The Carricks moved through the crowd with an escort of Rakhund. Aliens of a dozen species shifted and jumped to clear its way. Daffod recognized it by the way it moved and the colors of its flesh as clearly as if it had had a human face. The librarian of the human moiety. He didn't answer else except by rising to his feet. She followed him as he moved along the cathedral wall, past the entrances to half a dozen other alcoves. The librarian moved forward, lumbering with its massive forelegs, its abdomen hurrying to keep up. He couldn't have said why, but he had the sense that the Carrick scholar was pleased. It moved forward for a few minutes, then turned, curving to a place at the wall. A familiar place, it turned out. Another of the Carricks was waiting at the mouth of the Night Drinker's alcove. It was broader than the others Daffod had seen, and a wide chip was missing from its head, like something had taken a bite out of it when it was young. The little feather-haired, amber-eyed Night Drinkers were jumping from the holes in the fungal sponge that filled their space, running madly out into the crowd, then fleeing back to disappear into the wall. Daffod took the translator, pointing it as best he could toward the cacophony of their screeches. It didn't do anything. As their librarian approached, the notch-headed one lowered itself, spreading its dark, powerful arms to the side and pressing its body to the ground. The act of obeisance and surrender was strange to see in a Carrick's body, like seeing his father naked or vulnerable. The Night Drinkers scurried over to the debased Carricks, plucking at the air like they were trying to haul it back up through main force of will. This can't be good, Els whispered. Daffod shook his head, but he wasn't sure if he meant, no, it can't, or I don't know. He thought he caught the bass chirp and trill of the Carrick's native tongue, but it was hard to be sure in the noise, and his translator box was making no attempt to interpret. Other aliens were pausing to watch. A crowd was forming, making the same rough circle that surrounded violence since the first schoolyard. Daffod took Elsa's hand and drew her through the press of bodies. The vault above them echoed with inhuman voices. Whatever this was, he needed to see it happen. The notch-headed Carricks spread out its legs, four from the abdomen, the two thick, dark ones from its thorax. Even the pair of pale feeding arms, eight limbs spread. The librarian of the human moiety shuffled slowly around its colleague, paused, and then, with a crack like a whip, its huge arms snapped out and down onto one of the thin legs of the other Carrick's abdomen. The Night Drinkers shrieked and wailed, but the notch-headed Carricks only hauled itself up to its feet. The one leg hung broken and limp, but the others were enough to support it. Whatever the ritual meant, it seemed to be over. The two librarians stood face to face, and from closer in, Daffod was sure he heard their rumbling birdsong. Their demeanor seemed less like attacker and victim than two workers commiserating over a cup of coffee. After a few moments, the human's librarian shifted its attention to the pale Rakhund soldiers, and the soldiers swarmed forward. Knife-like legs shuddered against the spongy wall, ripping it apart. The night drinkers poured out in a group with lengths of metal like blunt-headed spears in their small hands and rushed at the minions of the Carracks. When they struck, the spearheads popped like a gun, and pale blood poured out of the Rakun's sides. There was no grabbing at the air, no attempt at surrender. This was life or death. And it wasn't life. It only took a flicker of one of the Rakun's bone legs, and a night drinker would fall. Some of them screamed as they went down, others just folded. Two of the Rakun turned their attention from taking down the wall and put their full efforts into slaughtering the animals that came out of it. At the side of the ongoing extermination, the Carracks chatted. The viewing crowd jostled for a better view, but they seemed to understand that Dafydd and Else had some connection to the abomination playing out before them. It took more than an hour to slaughter all the night drinkers and tear what had been their home out, piling it into a heap of crust, ink-black blood, and weirdly beautiful amber eggs that David had never seen before. In the end, a handful of the little aliens gave up on protecting their home and tried to flee, clutching armfuls of the eggs as they ran. They were cut down. Then, as if by common agreement, it was over, and the crowd unknotted. The Rakun kept hauling bits of dark substances out of the exposed alcove, but with the demeanor of janitors cleaning up a mess. The bodies of humanity's little rivals lay in a heap that rose as high as Dafydd's hips, all dead. Dafydd thought about vengeance for Irina, and then almost threw up, but choked it back. This wasn't anything more than a massacre. He wanted to flee from the scene, but couldn't, not certain why he wasn't moving. Else stood beside him, her face calm. "Was this us?" he asked, and his voice seemed to come from a long distance. "Was what us?" Else asked. "When we got them to surrender, did that mean this?" he said. Else sighed. "What is, is," she said, quoting the oft-repeated Carrick saying. And Dafydd finally vomited. Chapter 28. Gellert had changed. It was more than the thinness in his cheeks, more than the threads of grey that had popped into his hair, like the time since the fall of Asian could be measured in decades. She couldn't help wondering what changes he saw in her. Today, he'd taken her to the quarters he shared with his work group, made a lunch of the salty paste that the Carracks had left them as food and the plain water from the sink tap. Their conversation felt off, though, like her brother had become shy, or he was hiding something. The conversation circled back to the fall of Asian, the event having a gravity that bent all meaning back to it. "How did it happen?" he said, leaning back on the little chair where he or one of his crew kept watch. When he smiled wide enough, the dark gap of a missing tooth peeked out, but just for a moment. She didn't know how he'd lost it. It feels like that was a long time ago. Let's see, Lauren and Alston and Denia were all part of the near-field visualization group. We were letting them use our equipment since they were there for the, end of year at the Scholars Common," Jessen said. Gellert pointed at her, meaning, yeah, that. It wasn't the first time since they'd found each other again that he'd had trouble coming up with words. "So, when they came, they just got all of us," Gellert said. "We were waiting for a security escort to someplace safe, but it never showed up. The Carricks brought us here and gave us a lab. They wanted us to recreate Lauren's thin-spectrum lensing work, show them how he'd managed to see them before they wanted to be seen, and. There was a lot of room in that and. Loss and trauma. She knew it without having to be told. There was evidence everywhere. Bedrooms in their little compound that had been used and weren't anymore. Names that came up in conversation. Barris, Simeon, without a living person to go with them. A sense of the space where people had been. And there were habits like the keeping of the guard that implied violence. Everything she heard from Jellit was like an echo of what she'd been through. The abduction, the passage, the violence, the loss. Not her way through the mess, but a similar one, and the same mess. Even the rooms were like a funhouse mirror of each other, different and the same. The architecture here was blocky and rectilinear, and enameled in low saturation primary colors, like a child's playroom with the vibrancy taken out. Color and rhythm in place of her own window on the sky. The kitchen was like the one back at their rooms. They even had the exact same cups and plates, but here there was only one shower, and each of the bedrooms had a toilet and sink of its own. The bedrooms themselves were up on a second floor, only reachable by ladders. Here, there was a wide door, but it swung out instead of rolling. All the same pieces, arranged in more or less the same way, but with a carelessness. It was like the Carricks had a vague level of accuracy in making space for their pet humans, and close enough was close enough. They didn't care enough to keep them safe from violence, though, or from committing it. "I was worried, you know," he said. "Simeon had been taking something for his blood. It was hereditary, easy to manage. It was supposed to be easy to manage, you know, but they didn't get it for him."
"Did he die of that?"
"No, not of that," he said. And then, "I'm really proud of you, making it, even though... you know, even though my brain kept trying to kill me." He barked out a little laugh, and for a flicker she could see the version of him she remembered, bright, energetic, curious, alive. "Yes," he said, "even though your brain was trying to kill you. It was close sometimes." "Close is okay, as long as you made it. Ricker said you led the battle even before the medication came all the way back up. I guess all those coping skills sessions with the therapist paid off after all." He smiled as he said it, both teasing and not. For a moment she was in the house they'd lived in when she was 13, the summer her head had first betrayed her, sleeping in the main room with her father on a cot beside her because they weren't going to leave her alone until the medication started working. Her father, or her mother, or Jellit, barely older than her, he'd still taken a turn making sure his baby sister didn't hurt herself. She didn't know how a memory could seem that immediate and that far away at the same time. She'd been sure she was going to die back then. She'd known it like she'd known that the sun rose in the morning and set at night. Like she'd known that sugar was sweet and not salty. The only thing that had confused her at all was why her family didn't see it too. When her mind had clicked back into joint, it had been like it made a sound. The soft, wet, low crunch of a dislocated shoulder going back in its socket. She'd been just as sure that the rotten brain part of her had been wrong, and that this better version of Jessen was the real one after all. She thought her family would see that too. Wasn't that why they'd been standing watch over her? But the watch hadn't stopped so much as relaxed a little. There had never been a time after that when someone hadn't been watching her, at least a little. And that had been good. because her brain was a bastard, and it slipped when she least expected it. Even when she'd grown up and they'd moved away from her parents, Jellit, if no one else, always Jellit, had been there to see when she started to lose her footing and sit with her through the hard nights. This captivity was the first time in her life she'd actually been able to see whether she could survive a bad stretch on her own. The answer was no. She hadn't been able to. But she had been able to find other help. The insight was critical and deep and monstrously, monstrously unfair. If, she began, then cleared her throat and started over, if we were back on Asien, if we were back home, I'd let you go. I wouldn't let you pass up any more postings because of me. If we get home, we'll talk about it, he said. Their wide door swung open, creaking on a hinge that seemed to be made from some metallic fabric. Jellit sat back in his chair, putting a little space between them, like he didn't want his older friends to see him sitting too close to his kid sister. Some things didn't change. Alston was the first one in, wagging his eyebrows like he was following up some punchline, making whatever he'd said funnier by insisting that it was. Two women followed him. Denia, walking with the habitual deference of a research assistant, Merrill, tall and broad-shouldered, with a curly mane of black hair and weary confidence. Whatever conversation they'd been having stopped as they entered. Their smiles were warm and welcoming. Even after days of talking and eating together and sharing space, it still gave Jessen a little rush of joy to see the less familiar faces. The fact that people existed who weren't Tonner's work group was an ongoing source of relief, and evidence that sometimes the unexpected could be good instead of tragic. They exchanged pleasantries, and Merrill pulled up one of the blocky pastel-colored stools, but they didn't close the door. It drifted slowly back toward closed, but without latching. It would have been the work of a push to do it, and it seemed odd that none of them did until the door swung open again and Lauren Morse came in with Sinia. It wasn't odd that one of her group should accompany Lauren and the near-field group. That wasn't what raised the alarm. After all, Jessen was there herself. Kampar and Ricker had come for meals and the diversion of sleeping in a different set of rooms. Tonner stayed there whenever the discomfort of being around Else and Daffid was worse than the discomfort of being away from his lab. And Daffid and Else, busy as they were interviewing whatever aliens passed by, still made the occasional appearance. No. Something else raised the small hairs on Jessen's neck. Something about the brightness of Sinia's eyes and the tautness of her smile. This wasn't the quiet presence by the window, the woman who was slowly working through her grief. This was the Sinia planning violence in the dark. The thought was deeply unsettling even before the door swung open again and the other man came in. She didn't recognize him at first. In addition to shaving off his hair and growing a sharp, pale beard, Uris Ostenkor had put on a lot of muscle and lost what little fat he'd had by the end of their passage in the cold, orange-lit cell. His arms and neck were ropey, the musculature so defined it was like the skin had been painted onto a medical model. She thought he was deliberately dehydrating to make himself look like that. Ostenkor, who had organized the failed revolt in the transit cell, smiled almost shyly and put out his hand. Jessen hesitated. She had seen this man at his most vulnerable, near naked, sick, vomiting and shitting himself and weeping on the alien mat. He'd seen her in intimate moments, because everyone had. She'd had lovers when she was younger she'd shared less of herself with than she had with this man she barely knew. She felt exposed just seeing him, reminded of her humiliation and of his. There was no etiquette for meetings like this. She stood and shook his hand. His grip was just firm enough to say that it could have hurt if he'd wanted it to. "Austincourt," she said. "Jessen, I'm glad you made it." "Likewise." He let her go. Lauren Morse hauled over a stool for Austincourt and then sloped over to lean against the kitchen counter. The others arranged themselves in a rough semicircle, like they were wings and Austincourt was the angel. Jessen glanced at her brother. His shrug was a confession. This meeting wasn't coincidence. It had been planned. "I told you we'd found other groups."
"You did,"
Jessen said.
"You said that."
Austincourt lifted his hands, palms out. It looked more placating than surrender. Jessen sat back down, not realizing that she'd shifted to put a solid wall at her back until she'd already done it. "You probably feel a little ambushed," Austincourt said.
"Why would I feel like that?"
"Because I kind of ambushed you." His smile was quicker and easier than she remembered it from the cell. He also had more color in his skin than dull orange and black. She had a powerful memory of the man sitting by Cynia in the near dark, promising her that it wasn't over. "Not ambushed in a bad way, I hope. But I heard about your work group and everything you've been through. I think we should talk. And I don't know how much the big guys are listening in on us, but I try to give them as little to go on as I can. It's just good security hygiene." Behind him and to his left, Cynia nodded like one of the pious hearing a preacher. "You're in contact with a lot of other human groups?" Jessen asked. "It's been my project since I got here, tracking down as many of us as I could find." He sighed. "I think we know where about 300 of us are, all told. This complex seems to be a lot of the research and administrative captives. There were artists and writers in the cells, too. Either they're in a different complex, or a different part of this complex, or..."
"Or?"
"There were rumors that the artists got classed as extraneous, that they were executed. I don't know if that's true. There are a lot of rumors that don't seem to come from anywhere. We have Lauren's visualizations group, your biochemistry folks, a couple of labs worth of energetic physics, some logistics, and administration departments. That's less than half of the people we know were taken, but it's what I have to work with."
"It's not my group," Jessen said. "It's Tunner Freis's group. I just work there."
Austincourt's gaze flickered towards Cynia and away again. "The way I heard it, Tanner's not entirely in control these days."
"I guess you can make the argument that Daffod Alcor is setting some of the agenda that..."
"Not him," Austincourt said.
"You."
Jessen laughed. No one else did.
"Me? How do you figure that?"
"You're the one who fought off the night drinkers," Cynia said. "And you were the one who took the fight back to them. Tanner didn't. Daffod didn't. Kampar still calls you the war leader."
"He's teasing me," Jessen said.
"He's not." "I'm not asking you to fight," Austincourt said. "I have other people for that. But I do need a favor that only your group can do for me. Support."
"Support for what?" Jessen asked, but she already knew.
Stress, power, love. They didn't change people, but they revealed people as who they were. Austincourt, on the journey from Asian, had been ready to fight and kill. Now that he was here, his defaults were still the same.
The big guys give us a lot of freedom when it suits them to, Austin Kaur said. You've noticed that.
Your night drinkers were able to make bombs. I've seen other species gutting each other with mechanized drones and knives. We've been able to make these.
The object he took out from under his tunic was black and heavy. The metal shone in the light. If he'd been holding a venomous snake, Jessen would have felt the same urge to recoil away.
They're just little slug throwers, Austin Kaur said. About half of them are chemical propellant. The other half are magnetic pulse, but those burn out fast. There's no rifling. The accuracy is a joke, but they can still pop a hole in something.
You made guns.
And they let us. They don't care. Why do you think that is?
When Jessen didn't answer, Merrill did. She had a pleasantly deep, smoky voice. In another context, it would have put Jessen at ease.
Because they aren't scared of us. The things we can make aren't a threat to them.
Maybe, Jessen said. Or maybe the Kareks that are here are low enough status that the real powers don't care if a few of them die. She didn't say it aloud. The alarm in the back of her head was still sounding.
Austin Kaur put the gun on the table in front of her.
She thought he was presenting it for her to inspect. Like she'd be able to tell from looking that it was the real thing, that he was telling the truth. When he sat back and folded his hands in his lap, she realized she'd just been given it as a gift. She had a gun now. All she had to do was pick it up. She didn't.
If you're planning to start some kind of prison riot, I'm going to remind you how well the last one went, Jessen said. You can't win. Look at everything we've seen. Do you remember stepping out of the transit cell and seeing this place? You could put every human in Irvian in just this one wing of this one building. And the planet is covered with them. An insurrection can't win.
Depends on what the goal is, Alston said. If you're looking to get your old apartments on Ajian back, yeah, chances are grim. If winning means something else, though. See?
I do not, Jessen said.
But she did.
Austin Kaur meant dying gloriously, striking a blow at their oppressors, like an ant biting the toe of an elephant that had just crushed its nest. It wouldn't even rise to the level of moral victory.
You know how this is going to go, Austin Kaur said, and the warmth was gone from his voice. The coldness in its place wasn't angry or aggressive. He wasn't talking to her anymore. Not really. Everything he said, he was saying to himself. If we're good pets and do all the things we're told, we get the chance to live for another few days, or months, or years. If we're young enough, maybe we can have children to hand over to the Kareks for whatever they want to do with them. Is that the future you want?
It's that or die.
It is, Austin Kaur said. It's live as long as they let us live, and die how we're told to die. Or